Now, ladies and gentlemen, it's Friday afternoon, 4 p.m. in Central Europe. It's Space Cafe Scotland time. Our Space Cafe Scotland by Angela Matisse will begin soon. We would like to thank ESA Space Solution and Astro Agency for their great support for our event series. And as always, we really appreciate your participation and ongoing feedback. We constantly learn and improve based on the feedback you give us. Now, my name is Tara Wunter. I'm the event coordinator at Spacewatch Global. Spacewatch Global is a Europe-based online platform for information in and about space and new space activities in a geopolitical context. And I would like to thank all our private and corporate supporters that have showed their commitment to keeping our independent journalism alive. We really appreciate that. And with Angela Matisse, CEO of Think Tank Maths, we have found a great friend and a wonderful host for our outreach in Scotland. Now, I know many of you are already familiar with our website, our bi-weekly and daily newsletters, and the Space Cafe podcasts. Our latest episode features Bülent Altan, SpaceX veteran and Mynaric CEO, so definitely worth a listen. And for all our fans of audio content, we have new episodes in our Space Cafe radios, so stay tuned. Now, we also keep our fan shop online open for you to support us actively and become a space watcher. If you've missed any of our previous web talks, we have an archive on our webpage in the events section and on our YouTube channel. And we will host our Space Cafe Scotland live on a regular basis. Now, due to some technical mishaps, we lost the first minute of our wonderful conversation. So our lovely host, Angela Matisse, introduced her guest, Steve Greenland. Steve Greenland is the founder and managing director of Craft Prospect, a new space company providing AI-enabled space technologies, quantum encryption services, and mission systems consultancy. And not only that, he is also the director of Ominous Analytics, a Glasgow-based space technology startup delivering space data knowledge to support sustainable development. Now, the first question to Steve was, how did he become embroiled with UK space? So let's just dive right in.
So after 2 years, I came back to Scotland and then became involved in setting up the first Scottish CubeSat and first Scottish satellite UCube-1 and seeing that develop into the kind of the small, very small satellite industry that's based around Glasgow now.
So just because we just started the recording a bit early, so Steve has just told us that he, a new scientist, God, I used to read them avidly every week. I think it was every week or every month they came out as well, sort of in the 80s, 70s and 80s. Applied for something on the back. They said, come to Japan, and he did. And was invited to come over and take up this post working with the CubeSat, you know, leading edge in Japan, which just is amazing. So that is, that's incredible, incredible story. And I think it'll be very inspirational to people. So why did you start your own entrepreneurial journey? Sort of what was this, you know, you know, 5 years ago, you're saying that you actually sort of decided to leave. I don't know if it was the safe haven of the corporate world or wherever you were, another organization, and step out and take on all that stuff that is setting up a business.
It was a big leap for me. I wouldn't say that I'm normally so risk accepting. And maybe more risk averse, especially with a young family. But we were in the position where I'd come back from Japan, we'd set up UCube-1, we'd got that launched, we'd gone through that whole process within Scotland, and that was a lot of effort. It started off with sort of having to explain what CubeSats were back in 2008, 2009, trying to explain the potential of them. To government and to other stakeholders. And then seeing that develop and that being accepted and having lots of customers at Clyde Space looking to fly new and innovative payloads. And I just thought, wow, we've got this opportunity now, not just to build the platforms and build the spacecraft themselves, but to actually drive some of the new technologies and some of the new payloads forward within Scotland. And so I've taken a bit of a step back from Clyde Space and gone back to Strathclyde University to set up a missions lab there where we were looking at new technologies. And that itself had been a bit of a break from, I guess, the intensity of kind of building satellites to quite strict milestones. And so I wanted to set up a business that was going to explore some of these emerging technologies and be perhaps more on the customer side, as I understood it then, being able to look at these new missions and applications. Hence Craft Prospect, really, the idea of prospecting and looking around and trying to understand what we can do with space.
Fantastic. And so the ambitions for Craft Prospect, and talk about, but maybe any of the various technologies and things that you've brought in and you know, what are your goals within Craft Prospect? Sorry, can you Craft Prospect, and you know, and what's different about the sort of culture and things that you've built as well there. You've clearly brought sort of perspective that's quite refreshing there as well, if I understand rightly.
Yeah, I feel that the pressures on engineers delivering these very small satellites can be quite significant, especially when don't necessarily have the budgets or the safety nets of much larger programs, but a lot of the engineering challenges are the same. So I think there's a lot of individual responsibility placed on the engineers. And so what I wanted to do with Craft Prospect, as well as setting up a business that was going to explore some of these technologies, was to ensure that the engineers and the team were bought in and that their efforts were rewarded. So through employee ownership in particular, which I'm pleased to say we have some very pro employee ownership investors who are supporting the business to move more and more into the team's hands, as well as providing some significant cash reserves that we can use to invest in the business. And I kind of saw the other businesses. So in particular, businesses like architecture practices, where you have the architects as partners within the company. Mm. And I didn't really see the same within the space industry. It was more engineers delivering. And so I wanted to see engineers come through that and be able to become partners within the business. And that's the structure that we've tried to set up now within Craft Prospect. And I wouldn't say, you know, we've got all the answers yet. We're still just 5 years in, but we are seeing now more of the team is to take on parts of the business development, parts of the mission delivery, and being able to see a much wider perspective. And I think from that will come more and more opportunities, and it can then snowball. And that would be the goal.
Yeah. No, I can perfectly understand that. We've been, our own company's been sort of looking at that whole concept for quite some time, because I think it is. I think if people, you know, these days, it's particularly post COVID, I think, you know, people are looking for much more involvement. They're much more mobile, and they've got many more, you know, I think just engagement, you know, taking things on, not being pigeonholed into things. I think taking responsibility and understanding that, you know, this is not an academic world, because I imagine you've got a lot of academics in the business, and, you know, there's no handouts from government. It's all about making it work, right? It's so, is that a part of the dynamic and part of the outcomes that you were looking for?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a balance. As we transfer more of the business into the hands of the employees, then it's a two-way street, and it's a balance around being able to take responsibility and understand what that means. Mm-hmm. So we have support from our investors, capital colleagues. They run a business engagement program where they explain more about how a business is run, what it means when you look at a profit and loss sheet, how that relates to kind of the everyday running of the business, how the company is governed, these sorts of areas, so that everyone within the team really understands what that means. Mm-hmm. And so we can have a wider discussion about what we want as a business and where we can go in the future. Yeah, it's a very exciting, sometimes challenging thing to transfer that know-how and that passion and direct it, especially when you do have sometimes people coming from a more academic background where there might be some expectations around how things could be done. Sometimes commercial pressures will just drive the solution rather than the pure science or the pure engineering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm sure there's many people on this call who watch it later will understand those, and it's that balance. So yeah, well done for doing that. It really is. It's a great model. I think it's a great model. You know, belongs to the people. The company that comes to mind, which might not be familiar to people around the world, there's this sort of big store, chain store in the UK called John Lewis, and they've always had this. There's so it's ownership, it's employee ownership. It really is a great model. Well done for doing it. So what about the technologies and the solutions that you offer? What have you got?
Yeah, so we were growing the business kind of organically for the first 3-4 years. Then we needed to make sure that we had some parts of the business that were immediately commercial, and some which we were then able to take the profits from that and invest in future looking technologies. And so we selected three areas. The first was in mission architecture, where we support those looking to use CubeSats and very, very small satellites to understand the proposition and the limitations of these platforms and look to get those missions commissioned, contracted with a small satellite provider, and then launched and operated. And we've followed through from some concepts all the way through into operations now. And so that's provided revenue, which we could then invest into more innovative areas. The first was in the application of AI and machine learning on board satellites to provide more responsive operations, understanding that there's huge data bottlenecks that need to be solved in order to get all the information down that we can use on a satellite. And then in quantum technologies, where in particular we're interested in quantum communications, optical systems and security will play a significant role in future communications networks, and the role that space can have in providing some of that solution. Here we're looking at quantum key distribution, which is bring keys through a photon source, delivering those keys to locations globally using satellites, and then using those keys in the conventional, for example, internet to communicate and to secure the information.
Mm. So you're focusing sort of in on that, because you went through a whole raft of issues there, which is, I mean, the security piece, of course, is prime. Is that what you're focusing on at the moment? But there are...
We have our first mission, which actually brings together elements of both the quantum communications and the onboard intelligence. And the academic side, then we're taking knowledge from UK universities, in particular working with Strathclyde and Bristol, who have been working on quantum communications for some time and have real experts in those technologies, as well as our own work with BT in the UK, looking at secure networks and the role that CubeSats can play within wider systems, because we understand that CubeSats are not going to be the complete solution, right? They're still very limited. But they are important gap fillers. They are able to deploy technologies quickly. They are able to provide additional coverage when they provide part of an overall picture. And taking the commercial angle and the academic angle, bringing those together, adding on the onboard intelligence side some of our own work on cloud detection, so that we can more efficiently route the communication, as well as understand limitations such as the impact of cloud on the laser communication systems. Then we have our own complete mission, which we call ROCS. It's responsive operations for key services. And that's where we're focusing a lot of engineering effort now, because it brings together the whole gambit of different pieces of the business, but also it allows the team to come together and learn about how we can build systems, complete systems together, and turn those systems into modular products, which have use beyond just the application that we're using it for. So, for example, we are developing with partners at Fraunhofer very small optical communication telescopes, and this allows us to very finely direct our laser communication systems to the ground. But it will also then be applicable across optical laser communication systems in general, so for inter-satellite links and for other high throughput applications, not just quantum key distribution.
Well, everybody caught up with that. That was quite a journey. Pretty good set of stuff. So I don't know. I see Sonali has joined us as well. Is she online? Is she wanting to jump in at any point on the technology? I know she's pretty key on all of that, but I think you're doing a great job. She's okay. There for backup. So now they've been also from Graft Prospect. So you've mentioned rocks. I mean, that just sounds an amazing entire portfolio. Wow. You also have, the Omanos project, which I, you know, is just, having just taken a view of it, to help to make sure that as humans develop the planet, right? I mean, as we develop the planet, we are very careful of people and the creatures that live in those, right? But over to you. So maybe tell us a bit on Manos, because that is most people would be satisfied with doing that business just on its own. I don't know many. You live in quantum. You live in you've got like what many dimensions in your world.
It was around. I think in redundancy, when as a systems engineer, we're trained to look at how we can make a system more redundant. And starting a business is obviously a high risk area. So why not do two and see what develops further. And that was kind of where I was back 5 years ago. I'd been discussing with a colleague, Celia, who's my co-founder for Omanos, the problems of supporting journalists in hostile or low infrastructure countries, as she did then, and connecting their subjective experiences with some quantitative data that could then be used to back up stories. And we found upon kind of use cases where space had a really nice role to play and could back up those stories. And so we kind of set upon the idea of, well, how do we turn this into something which is more useful, more scalable, for a wider collection of people and looking at communities where they might have been impacted by, multinationals in mining, context, taking a piece of land, but not having the records to be able to back that up. We could show, in court that the land had been used by the community for a specific application, namely for agriculture. And therefore we were able to, get that patient, for that community. And so that kind of proved the concept. And we're now working with a range of NGOs in areas, such as mining, oil and pollution monitoring, prisons, looking at the size of prisons. You can tell a little bit about, the size of cells potentially, and how they have been, how they can then connect to the experiences of those who have been in those prisons. Space just provides this fantastic, source for data that can back up the subjective human experiences. And really the interesting thing is how different it is from craft prospects, where craft prospect is very much in the upstream, working on future high technologies. And really the focus with Amanus is downstream, the human elements, the very simple steps that we can take to remove barriers from accessing and interpreting this kind of data.
Oh, we're losing you a little bit there. I don't know if your microphone.
I don't know.
Yes, back again. Ah. Well,
that's it.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's many things just flashing through. I mean, last night I saw something on the peat bogs in Africa that have been a massive peat bog that's just been discovered, and humanity actually probably didn't even know, and to preserve it. I mean, it's a peat bog the size of England, apparently.
Wow.
It was on the news last night. And so, you know, if we're not careful and we just allow, you know, the usual sort of roll in, we're saying it is the usual suspect, it's industry. You know, there's always this dichotomy, isn't there, about balancing industry and need for growing wealth in nations. But this is a huge sump, obviously, for CO2, a massive sump. You know, imagine a peat bog the size of England, for goodness sake, in an African forest. So amazing. Yeah, I can imagine. And then there's also the story, of course, of the two folks that disappeared in South America. So it's yeah, wow, that is a fantastic geopolitical tool. And I think there's some people be listening on here who really are indigenous people, you know, helping to preserve their environments, helping to work with them. That's a pretty engaged agenda there, right?
We've had some fantastic support from the UK Space Agency and ESA. Unfortunately, the IPP program through the UK Space Agency is now ended. But through that, we were able to develop a mobile phone application that could be configured for collecting ground truth data. So we could use that and roll that out, and allow the local community to collect relevant data and then connect that to the Earth observation data and the data interpretation specialists. So that was a really nice outcome.
And have you managed to get journalists around the world to use it, or is it just how well known is your system?
It's still in the sort of the prototyping stage. So we've used it in a number of contexts looking at noise pollution in geothermal plants development in Kenya, because these are huge areas that are being developed for geothermal, and that's a fantastic renewable energy source, but it also has impacts on the communities around it, and so being able to record that and connect that then with the Earth observed data sets becomes really very valuable in creating these trusted networks of individuals who are able to collect that data.
And are you finding, just out of interest, I mean, are you finding that the corporations that are in, you know, because they do have corporate responsibility now, the sort of HSE, I mean, are you finding that this is a tool that they actually want to know, because they're not, they don't have the means either to, can't measure something, as a good friend of ours, Mr. Jha says, Dr. Jha says, can't measure it, you can't do anything about it, because you don't know anything about it. So for them, is this a tool to help them actually understand the impact of project they had to see how it's panning out?
Yeah, I think that will be one of the avenues we'll be exploring with Amanus. Currently, we're mostly supported through larger NGOs who are looking to collect data, and they might be funded, for example, through advocacy to support a particular community. Corporate social responsibility agenda, it provides a massive opportunity there for sure.
Mm-hmm. I mean, water as well, you know, as it really say, that's looking at the, again, you know, just tends to be sort of a junkie of all of this.
Yeah, I mean, they're massive problems, but it's really kind of connecting the individuals and
taking on the ground, the people on the ground. Yes, you can just observe, but you've actually got that interaction. That's a huge piece. You know, the sort of the human experience of it, to do the comparative. That's amazing. It's really great. I think that's, I mean, I think we're, you know, you have got sort of, you know, such a lot going on. What is next? I mean, what are you aiming for? Where are you going to take all of this? Because I, you know, my brain is kind of going all sorts of directions. I can imagine you could, and the general, although you've got applications for them, they're all quite ubiquitous capabilities, as you know, I recognize from our own business, lots of things we do. You, part of it's like a Swedish shop. How do you, what's next?
Yeah, I think it is about the underpinning technologies and developing those to the point that they can be applied in lots of different areas. So for us, for Craft Prospect as a business, then the main focus right now is to get the first mission delivered, to get rocks delivered, whilst at the same time, we've been fortunate enough to secure a number of different commercial opportunities to supply parts from the rocks development into other missions. So for example, we're working with Honeywell and the Canadian Space Agency to deliver a quantum source onto their satellite. We're working with SSTL to integrate some of the intelligent processing that we've developed onto their satellite systems. And that sort of modular products that we can produce through start spinning out into new areas. And so rocks remains this kind of draw together of all of these different pieces. Where we are right now, we've just gone through quite an intense period. For those in the UK, they might be aware of the National Space Innovation Programme, and it's been very short, 6 month sprints of funding to develop missions. And so within this most recent sprint of 6 months, we've gone from CDR through to producing flight models and getting those integrated into a satellite ready for testing. And that's been fantastic. It's been a huge challenge for the team coming back from COVID as we were, to take essentially paper designs with some prototypes, get them produced, get all of these different disparate pieces integrated on board a satellite. It covers, you know, embedded engineering, the FPGAs, the optical systems, the science behind it. And so seeing the team come back together after this period of prolonged isolation to some extent, it has been a huge both relief, but also just fantastic to see.
Oop, we've got again. We've gone again. Oop. Go on. I think we've got it.
Yeah, I was just saying, just seeing the kind of the team come bounce back really and back into the swing of things and getting all the new pieces of the technology puzzle in place and tested.
And is it possible to do this distance, or do you have people, are they all back in office and working together? Because it sounds like there's a lot of collaboration.
Yeah, we're now 4 days a week back in the office. For the types of technologies that we're working on and the intensity, in order to meet the delivery timelines and to get these systems, these very interdisciplinary systems delivered, then that's necessary at the moment. That's for sure been a challenge over these last 2 years, kind of keeping those systems going. I think coming into this last period, then questions around technical debt, because as a systems engineer, you don't necessarily have visibility about exactly where all these different pieces are and how far they've developed. And it's not until you've started integrating them and physically seen how the software gets installed, how the optical alignment works, that you know that you've made progress. And so now we've got to the point where we have very visible progress with a satellite integrated or payload integrated on the bench to show.
Oh, you've gone again. I don't know what's going on with your mic. It keeps. Yeah. So I think are you there again? Can you speak?
Yeah.
So it's almost like, you know, I'm sort of imagining, so everybody's sort of way hiving away, and it's not to bring it all back in and to see that actually it does all come together. And that's an incredible process to go through. And I'm sure it's, you know, it's part and part of the industry. Well, look, I think people are going to have lots and lots of questions. Anybody out there got a question they want to ask Steve?
I think there are already quite some questions in the Q&A. I think a lot of them from Nicholas, who's very engaged. So one of his questions is, what is your view on the need of artificial gravity on space stations?
I wouldn't be an expert in that field. I would expect that physiologically, especially for long duration missions, then that would be an absolute necessity for human spaceflight to avoid muscle wasting. But yeah, not so much my field, I'm afraid.
Then we can dive into a question that Tom has on the topic of sci-fi inspiration, which it's a very interesting question. So he says, a lot of technologies have developed from sci-fi inspiration, from a voice interactive computer to portable communication devices. What space technologies do you think are being explored, possibly inspired by sci-fi, and what are you excited about?
Okay. Yeah, I think I can speak to that more easily. So for me, actually, it wasn't so much sci-fi, but actually a book by Robert Zubrin of the Mars Society as a child. And it was the Case for Mars. And it was a somewhat a fictional account of what the first Mars missions would look like, but coupled with some quite rigorous analysis and science behind the systems that would be required. So he was a great inspiration to me and made me want to set up my own business. I remember as something like a 12 or 13 year old going to my parents and asking for £50 so that I could set up a Mars mining company and to try and register it. I'd say the whole exploration agenda within space is very much inspired and takes inspiration from science fiction, but also from the kind of the science greats who have already written down how they think it could go. And so they've provided a roadmap for a lot of us to follow.
Well, and you know, the art of the possible. You know, the future, the art of the possible. What's your view on that? Maybe here's a question that's been going through my mind as we've been speaking. What are the stubborn problems? What are the outstanding stubborn problems that maybe stubborn problems that you've managed to crack? And then sort of, you know, and what are the stubborn problems of the future where we'll need some kind of, seismic shift in an approach to something and to make it happen?
So I think I'd probably answer in a couple of ways. I think the for Craft Prospect as a business, then it's how to allow these technologies to become integrated into existing systems. Sometimes it's not really about whether or not a particular technology works. It's more about how you can integrate that into existing infrastructure in order to efficiently improve a service. And so the thinking about the two technologies that we work on, more secure communications using quantum keys and onboard AI and machine learning. Well, especially for the machine learning, there's the challenge of how do you assure that and how do you build confidence? How do you build the basic data sets that enable a large system integrator to adopt such capabilities? And that's really about picking the right use cases and finding where are the use cases where you can add value without adding any further risk, or ensure that the system is only going to improve by the addition of these capabilities. So by that, I would imagine areas like real-time decision making, where there wouldn't be any other way to make that kind of judgment call within the time period. And that can allow a much more, an area where you can insert that technology, prove it, and then start building a more assured framework and roll that out into other areas. And then in the quantum key domain, then I think it's about how do you work with existing telecoms companies, right? Because there's so much infrastructure that already exists that underpins everything we do. So how do you make something that's quite science fiction about the polarization of photons and using that to distribute keys, and how do you integrate that in into a digital phone network? And so those are the sorts of questions which I'm really interested in for the business. Thinking more widely about kind of the big problems that humanity is facing around kind of climate change, and it's all about kind of getting the information in a form that can be acted upon to the people who really need it. That's kind of the other side of Amanus. It's about kind of the human element side. And that's still a massive problem that I don't think we're just starting to scratch the surface. My instinct is that something like advanced processing and AI systems will help that, because there's so much knowledge that needs to go to so many people that the scaling up of any of these kinds of capabilities will require it.
And, you know, there's in talking about, you know, the quantum spectrum as well and keys. I mean, we're all aware that there's, you know, more and more security needed for, you know, for even using a computer. It's almost like, yes, it was fine, you know, when like, okay, hackers were there, but they were quite, you know, we could keep a pace, but now it's ramping so fast. How do, you know, is this question, what good to have your view, is being online and is using the internet for payments and communications, no matter whether they're strategic governmental communications or whether they're just, you know, trying to keep your own conversations private, those kinds of things. Is this where you see? I mean, there really needs to be some kind of shift there. Is this where you think that this quantum capability could play, or am I?
In time, yeah. I think that the immediate needs will be more around those areas which require forward security. And by that, I mean something which retains its value far into the future. So that might not be a financial transaction. It might be more about the messages that you've been sending for the last 20 years. Or it might be diplomatic cables. It might be oil and gas surveys. And these sorts of pieces of information retain their value much further into the future. And therefore, if you're using current communication networks to distribute those, then we need to use future secure systems to secure them, and make sure that we're robust against future attack. And with the emergence of quantum computing, then I'm not sure that we believe that the current methods of securing that data are sufficient. Hence why quantum keys and post-quantum cryptographic methods will start to emerge. And it will be those areas that we'll see adoption.
Because there is this sort of, you know, we're building more and more, and even smart, you know, you can have smart systems that manage fine as long as they're not tampered with. And as long, you know, and it's sort of like we already, you know, the stats, the numbers are that there's 11.2 billion of UK GDP is dependent on, you know, satellite systems are up. But then the businesses that they provide information to is something like 300 billion per annum. This is massive, you know. Yeah. And if something happens in this environment, then the economic, the economic stability. I think we're sort of seeing that, and kind of the elephant is in the room on this one. The conversation obviously with what I'm thinking, but you know, it is a massive piece of the puzzle. And I think, you know, there's been anybody who's had their card hacked, buying online, which is just a very simple thing, and massively hacked online. Just how secure is the internet these days? Should we And how do we revert back? There doesn't seem to be any way back to that, but we do need to move forward.
Yeah. The assurance and the trust that we have in our networks, which really we need to pay attention to. The thing that might be more worrying is, well, what happens if the space data, we just don't know which one is the truth?
Yeah.
Where we've got two sets of data coming down and they appear to conflict. How do we resolve that?
Do you mean being spoofed?
Yeah, potentially spoofed. I think there's a number of different attack vectors which could end up with us in a position where we don't know what truth looks like, or we don't know what truth looks like in a time where we need to make a decision.
Yeah.
And that I think is something that will affect not just space data, but all sorts of data. But that ensuring that space remains this reliable source when you see it being used as it has been recently in all types of journalism, from reporting of
you've got again.
I was just saying, when you look at how much space knowledge and Earth observation data is being used, from the war in the Ukraine through to climate change monitoring, if questions start being raised about the validity of the data that's coming down, then we end up in a very difficult position.
Yeah. I think we've, coffees and people have those. It's, you can simulate anybody, you have to be good at looking at it, but these simulations and even people, people's faces and voice and whatever, and, are we actually looking at anything at all? But I think in this whole domain where we have this reliant, it's almost, we just use the users of technology, but that, the cleverness is staying ahead of the ways to hack, imitate, spoof, etc., which is just immense. Another, before we go, because it's just, oh my goodness, it's, I feel as if, it's, and I can see people saying this is the best. I can see Nicoletta saying this is the best space cafe that she's been on. The other is, you were saying about systems in space and intelligent systems in space and dealing with that situational awareness and updating systems that adapt. The piece that, I suppose there, the Holy Grails, we've been facing that too, this business. That's one of the core areas that our company Think Tank Maths does, but it's, known unknowns and then unknown unknowns. And how do you get a system, statistical, if you're going to use statistical, there's always the black swan event, right? I mean, you just cannot rely on, specifically if you're talking about something that's 22,000 kilometers away, how real is real when you're making that decision, is the system intelligent enough? Has it gathered enough information? And I think it's this bounded trust, as I think that you were mentioning. I mean, the example on this is, and people don't often think about this. Well, maybe we all do that are on here because we're all a bit geeky. But the first Apollo mission, there was no way a human being could possibly make the adjustments and decisions on the re-entry. Even if you take the re-entry, it was a computer that managed the re-entry processes to do the adjustments and adaptations to the whole re-entry atmospherics, right? So that was a bunch of human beings sitting inside a capsule coming flying through sort of the Earth's atmosphere. So these are bounded, but in trying to keep things secure and getting a system that's almost, like a child growing up and learning the environment, how do you get things that then, because the past does not predict what will happen in the future, and this is always going to be the conundrum, right? I love this. We're right at the cutting edge of this. What are your thoughts on that?
I think the first point is with care and with ensuring that the use cases that we're starting to deploy these technologies in are very carefully bounded, and that we ensure that the legislation and the insurances and everything that needs to sit around a system has been defined before we start rolling out to different use cases. So the types of use case that I think are most interesting at the moment are ones where Maybe you have a larger Earth observation satellite and you have two potential areas to image coming up, and you can only image one and you don't have time to communicate down to the ground and get feedback from a human about which one should be selected. But you do have to make a decision. And do you just stick rigidly to a schedule and whatever's been scheduled, or do you try and use whatever sensor information you have about what's coming up to make that decision slightly more intelligently? Because you have to choose one of the other. And those sorts of decisions, I think, are the ones which we can more easily integrate into operations now. And the learning from doing that will allow us to take these further steps along the path to kind of complete autonomous systems. But for sure, there's a lot of challenges along the way. And it will be fascinating to see, map out and resolve. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this would fascinate you. I mean, honest to goodness, I think I'm going to jump the car sometime very soon, come through and see you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
With a couple of people in tow. But, you know, I mean, we had a conversation during COVID with the Jet Propulsion Lab of NASA, sort of looking at the moon environment is one, but the Mars missions, these are unknown unknowns. How do you prepare? You know, and that's the question. So here's the question. Mm. And I know that's out there, but these are the things that we're going towards. It's almost insane that humanity is sort of doing this. And yet I like the idea, and I've got to say this, I got real comfort from the concept that some of the stuff you're developing with Omanos is that oil companies and development companies and maybe, you know, people planting stuff. And I can see Dan Hawk is on here. Hello, Dan. Thank you for joining, you know, Indigenous First Nation people of the USA and other First Nations. You know, we've had Maribaja has had folks from the Maui and the Aboriginal communities and many others. I don't want to be exclusive on those. You know, but when we're progressing, we call it progress. It's not progress if we're not able to be more careful. And I think there is a need. I mean, everybody is getting to the point where, you know, if you have children, you must be living in angst about, you know, what world you're leaving them. And we used to talk about this glibly in the past, and this whole sustainability piece. So I think it's brilliant that you're doing all of that. But we are looking at how do we create systems where there are unknown unknowns? How do you prepare that? How does a system decide, you know, what's your view? How do you get a system dealing with known unknowns is and predicting what might be coming, but unknown unknowns? Do you have any views on that?
We have worked on some kind of self-learning systems, and maybe they will become more employable in future. I think near term, we're not looking to.
No, you're talking about learn. You know, they're learning, and what are they referring to? They're referring to only sort of things that have happened in the past, right? And it's this piece about what's going to come at you, as I said, the past predict what the future is going to be. And that goes for all of us here, but somehow we kind of, I think that's a big, would you agree that's a kind of a grail that maybe we should have this, we should get our teams together and sort of see what we can.
I think it's really interesting to see what we come up with, and it could be the start of a great research proposal for sure.
I think so. Folks, I'm getting really sort of into this. Are there any other questions? Anybody wants to jump on, say anything to Steve? I think we'll all agree this has been, I think you've demonstrated, there's a whole piece here as well as how have you actually managed to, that's a lot of business development you've done there, you know, a lot of contacts, a lot of getting into the right people, proving bits of the technology so that it will, you know, it's kind of primed to be able to be part of the puzzle. I mean, do you have some master plan in your head and do you have, you know, is it sort of credibility that you've built up? I mean, 5 years is not a lot, you know. Talking to you, you'd think you've been around for 20 years. How have you managed to build this amount of contacts and credibility in a five-year period?
I've been very fortunate in the positions that I've been in, and obviously Clyde Space had a huge part in that, because we were certainly within the UK the first company going out and speaking to anyone about CubeSat and to promote the idea that we could do space slightly differently. And so as the lead systems engineer, I was able to go out and meet people, have those kinds of conversations and listen and hear a lot of what could be done in the future. So I'm very fortunate to have had that experience and then being able to use some of that network and some of those contacts to start when starting this business, albeit looking at a slightly different angle, being about the new technologies that we can bring in I've just seen someone mention they're using cloud space components. Fantastic.
So you're growing still, or are you consolidating at the moment?
Yeah, so we've grown relatively fast. Obviously, I'm still a new managing director. I've only got 5 years heritage on my directorship, so still learning for sure. We've grown now in craft to 20 or around 20, and I think we'll stay sort of within plus minus 5 of that for the next period while we consolidate and we bring everyone back from COVID and we start developing new operational practices within the business. Because I think that now with the investment, that's the time, and the opportunities that have been presented to us, now's the time to kind of consolidate, get the first products flown either within our own mission or with our partners, and then look for further growth. But you know, the world has lots of surprises for you when you're doing this. So that's the plan. But
roller coaster.
Who knows? Yeah,
a roller coaster.
Absolutely. And with Amanus, then it's probably a slightly slower growth curve, in that it's all been organic to date. So that's people working full time. So that will kind of, I think, keep growing on a step by step basis.
I didn't feel this is a smorgasbord. I think this is a smorgasbord for, like, you know, anybody who wants to work on any side of this sort of business. I think, as you know, as you said, so the ups, the, you know, you know, do the technology side or do the application side in impacting humans. You've actually got a separate team on Manus rather than on the.
We're located in the same offices, and especially now that kind of everyone's back. But yeah, it's separate to the point, but there's so many synergies between the teams, and there's a lot of conversations between them, and we can learn a lot from each other, knowing how the two sides of the equation balance, the upstream and the downstream, how the technology can deliver more capability downstream, and how the downstream needs can influence the technologies that we want to fly.
Okay. Chiara's just put another question up. Chiara, do you want to bring that one in?
Yes. On the topic of craft. So we have a question here from Jack Wood, who says, do you foresee craft continuing to target CubeSats or eventually moving on to larger satellites?
I think that's a good question, Jack. I think that the CubeSat market is a really good market for first proving and gaining flight heritage. It tends to be more risk accepting, and therefore is a first entry market. But no, I think that the types of technologies that we're developing within craft are underpinning and therefore applicable to much larger systems in time. I think that the kind of caveat to that is the different levels of assuredness that are needed. So it's not just about the components themselves, but it's about how you go about the processes and how you can demonstrate that kind of traceability that's required in much larger satellites. And so as we build and develop the team, and as we build these experiences, then we'll be able to go and engage with much, much larger missions, or that would be the goal in time.
Mm-hmm. And the word sustainability. So how does that fit into all of your, we're all grappling with we don't want to stop the industry, but at the same time, we don't want to be putting stuff up there that just burns out, destroys the atmosphere. We don't want to be launching things. I mean, what are your views on that? It would be improper not to ask you that question.
Well, I think there's a few different areas. I mean, the idea that we can use our technologies as secure and hosted payloads, which means that we can launch them on other satellite platforms. We can then make more multi-use satellites, so we don't have so many different platforms. I think that there is this huge growth in the number of space platforms which are going to be launched. I think it's just between OneWeb and SpaceX, I think the number is maybe 40,000. So in terms of sustainability, and it needs to be very rigorous legislation around space traffic control and how we deorbit and how we measure the impacts of these satellites on the Earth and the impacts that it has on kind of everyday human activity. I would be, you know, thinking about the Omanus use cases and the engagement with mining companies who have taken land from communities. Well, space is a joint asset as well, and we need to make sure that isn't taken from the collective humanity, and that is properly managed, and that needs organizations like the UN to, and I think the Space Development Agency in the US and others to kind of step up and ensure that is enforced on the companies who have got these huge plans.
Yeah. Are you going to, next week is this in London, is going to be the Sustainable Space Symposium?
It's it's on my list of events that I would like to attend.
Yeah, it's on mine too. We can get a train, get a plane down.
And strikes that are coming.
For those around the world that might be listening, Britain's heading for a massive sort of transport strike, and right in the middle of this fantastic conference that we all wanted to sort of head to, where the International Space Symposium on the Sustainable Space is taking place. Look, are there any other questions, Kiara? I don't want to leave anybody sort of out in the cold who's come on this and has got a question. And as I explained to you, I don't want to squint too hard at the question listing.
Do you have a few more questions, but looking at the time, maybe we can take one more, which is from Chris, and he asked, how do you acquire customers? Do you leverage space agencies?
So space agencies can be helpful, particularly in forming relationships with other companies. Typically, types of systems that we work on will require some configuration to a particular customer's use case or other technologies, and therefore having some support from a space agency or innovation agency to fund that initial engagement, I think really helps. To build the relationships and test the relationship. So yes, we do. But equally going out and fortunately now we can going out to conferences and just speaking to others and finding out what they're doing. Be that in kind of a more formal setting or once the conference itself is over, going out for dinners and coffees and chatting. I find that just as productive in terms of finding customers and build that's back on the table. I know this is remote, but it's so much that we lost through the.
Well, we're saving that. We're contributing to reducing the carbon. You know, if Kiara's where she is, you're where you are, and I am, and everybody else that's on here, we wouldn't be able to meet like this if we all had to jump on a plane. It would be a bit mental. Look, I think I really must thank everybody who's participated in and all the enthusiasm I can just feel coming out of the chat box and the questions. And I think we've got to thank Chris. I mean, it has been, as I said, you know, a sort of deep dive into a whole raft of things. It's almost like being in a sweetie shop speaking to you, but so many capabilities. But yet you're putting together these wonderful packages of capability. And I think the inspiration is for young and budding scientists and people that, you know, what can I do with space? You know, what can I do is, you know, are all the problems solved? And, you know, or is it all, you know, is science going to be applicable to? I think you've shone a light on that immensely as to what are some of the challenges that still have to be done and the really exciting jobs that people can do if they, not just in STEM, but, you know, I imagine in your organization that are project managers and, you know, getting all this aligned and getting it together. It's not, you know, it's not often, you know, just having a a team of scientists is sometimes it's like herding cats. So you need people with soft skills, right, to be able to pull that together. Would you agree?
For sure. I think that we sometimes give engineers and scientists a bit of a bad name. I think that certainly with it might not come naturally to all engineers and scientists, but training in kind of the softer skills and ensuring that you've got quite a diverse and inclusive team becomes really, really important to see, help each other to cover the gaps, but also to learn from each other. I agree, but I also think that we shouldn't ever have lower expectations of engineers and scientists. I think that they can definitely step up and
do this. But it's the guidance. It's the guidance given the right framework and structure. Yeah, absolutely. When I met Sonali on sort of a masked encounter in a restaurant in Edinburgh, for the first time after I'd spoken to her several times online, and she said, "You really have to talk to Steve. He's an incredible, individual with a huge amount of experience, and I'm really not disappointed. And must thank you for that." It's another
thing. We have Sonali to thank for the introduction, then. So thank you.
Brilliant. Anyway, thank you all. I'm going to hand back to Chiara. I would just say that anybody who enjoys all of this, you know that you can become an ordinary member of Spacewatch Global, a little bit of your pocket money, or, instead of buying whatever it is that you spend on, you can become a sponsor and supporter of Spacewatch Global. I think the fact that we've got this platform for around the world to be able to have these conversations and all of the other information that that Spacewatch Global provides around the world, letting people see this kind of what is emerging, what are the issues, who's doing what. It's certainly my go-to every morning when I come out as well. So I would just remind everybody, if you're enjoying this and you're enjoying everything else that they offer, then do go in and be a sponsor. And of course, you can become a small corporate, everything's proportioned to the size of it. So companies can also make a contribution to the effort of Spacewatch Global and these brilliant people that are making it happen. Back to you, Chiara, speaking of some of the smiling and brilliant and energetic people of Spacewatch Global.
Thank you so much, Angela, for those kind words. And huge thank you also to Steve for this great session. I think I've learned a lot, judging by what's been written in the chat. I think a lot of people have learned a lot. And I'd also like to thank the audience for all their questions. I know that we didn't manage to cover every single one, but we will get back to those in the future for sure. Now, before we finish for today, I would just like to mention that we do have some exciting events still coming up. So next week, on the 21st of June, we'll have our 33 minutes with Dr. Deganit Pakowski on her theory of the space club. And then for the all of next week, our Spacewatch team is going to be heavily represented at the ILA Air Show in Berlin. And we'll actually have three of our space cafes live on stage. On the 24th, the 25th, and the 26th of June, we'll have two Space Cafe Germanys and a Space Cafe Young Global Talents on the stage in German, but of course also able to follow along at home as well. So hopefully we'll see you there. And then on the 28th of June, we'll have our next 33 minutes with Graham Turnock on ESA's accelerators. Now, all our events are going to be online on Eventbrite. And as always, we love to hear your feedback. So please check in with us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Don't forget to sign up for our daily and our biweekly newsletters. And if you want to treat yourselves to something special, become a Space Watcher today or help us out in the supporter program, as Angela already mentioned. Again, thank you all so much for your interest today, for all your questions. A huge thank you to Angela and Steve for this inspiring and informative talk and for being our guests. And thanks to the entire team behind the scenes for always doing this great job week in and week out. And of course, thank you to ESA Space Solution for their support. Now, I hope that you all stay safe and stay healthy. Thank you so much for joining us and for being so active. I hope to see you in the next week. And in the meantime, visit our website, follow us on social media, and don't forget, become a Space Watcher. Thank you.